The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Rebuilding the Philippines. After the disaster, grief, and relief, some lessons on recovery and reconstruction from the Asian tsunami of 2004.
Retreat on Obamacare. The president is forced to seek revival of policies people liked, shadowing the whole program, his political health, and larger agenda.
Unhealthy mental health. The largest operator of freestanding psychiatric centers in the U.S. has a history of problems rarely considered by state regulators.
Why Camelot continues. On the 50th anniversary of John Kennedy's assassination, a look at his lingering image and influence on presidents ever since.
A birthday cocktail. Cabaret queen Andrea Markovici celebrates 65 in the bygone era of supper club society with a touring show called Moonlight Cocktail.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only. Now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For your ears only, for the week of November 17th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth.
All I hear, many cry, many people crying. Many people say, help, help.
We're going to move stuff as they direct. As the Philippine government and their armed forces ask us for support, I've got airplanes and helicopters. I've got airplanes that can look for people in areas that are stranded. That's what I do.
What may have been the biggest and baddest typhoon in world history, with winds around 200 miles an hour at times, left dramatic devastation and human tragedy that continued, even as Marine General Paul Kennedy began coordinating a much slower second wave of aid from the United States and around the world. 1 week out, the official death toll was close to 4,000, with at least 1,000 more still missing, and 2 million homeless or facing dangerous health conditions and hunger. The delay in aid prompted criticism of President Benigno Aquino's central government and of local authorities, including the family of former First Lady Imelda Marcos that dominates the worst-hit area around the city of Tacloban.
There was harsh reaction as well to the paltry aid first offered by regional superpower China, only $100,000 compared with $20 million pledged by Washington. Beijing later upped its contribution to $1.6 million in supplies like tents and blankets. But even as the immediate crisis continues, experts suggest that relief and reconstruction would benefit from lessons learned after the tsunami that devastated much of Asia in 2004. To spotlight those lessons, for your ears only, we're joined now by Akash Kapoor, a frequent magazine contributor from Pondicherry in South India and author of India Becoming, A Portrait of Life in Modern India, published last year by Penguin. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You wrote last week about how that second wave of aid can often be too much of a good thing and sometimes not such good things. Talk about some of the inappropriate or excessive aid that followed the 2004 tsunami.
Well, I mean, I guess the first thing I'd emphasize is that it's not a question of saying that aid can be too much or that there shouldn't be aid. I mean, particularly when you hear things like in your lead-in that, you know, about some countries having committed paltry aid, I just want to emphasize that we're not talking about the fact that there should be less aid. But what is important to emphasize is that the nature of the aid and the quality of the aid does matter. And in particular, I mean, we saw after the tsunami that as sort of heartwarming as it was to see such large amounts of money pouring in, a lot of the time the aid didn't really match the needs on the ground. And so you had stories, for example, about tsunami survivors receiving packages of Viagra or ski jackets or winter jackets. Or in one case, I think it was in Indonesia, they received 75 tons of expired medications. So, you know, that's obviously a case where the intentions might be good, but the aid is probably not going to do much good for the survivors.
Cash aid can have its own problems depending on the competence and fairness of the government and non-government agencies that generally receive and distribute it. Talk about leakage of aid funds and the way they can widen disparities of wealth and power.
Leakage, in particular, in the way I used it in the article, leakage is sort of a euphemism for corruption. So that's one problem, obviously, when you've got tons of money pouring into an area, you know, it can get siphoned off in various ways and not reach its intended recipients. The other problem that you're referring to there is when aid is not necessarily siphoned off, but it's sort of captured by local interest groups. So, you know, when aid pours into, let's say, a rural area or a village or something, it's often the aid groups or the government, for that matter, are interfacing with power structures in that group. And it's quite natural for the sort of most powerful forces in that group to get the lion's share of the aid. And that's something that aid groups have to be and often are very aware of, but have to sort of work with.
One solution, you say, is involving more grassroots village and self-help groups.
You know, that's sort of the aid groups or the government agencies dealing with the villages or with the affected areas. I think what I saw around here after the tsunami is that these groups need to be very involved in sort of interfacing with local groups and reaching out in particular to groups that represent sections of society that tend to be historically more marginalized. So it could be, for example, women's groups. In the case of India, it would be groups representing the caste, you know, known as untouchables. Every society has its own marginalized groups, and often they do have bodies or groups that represent them. And it's very important to be working with those groups to make sure that the less powerful sections of society receive aid, too.
But spreading money around like that also carries the danger of what you call Dutch disease. Why that name and what does it mean?
You know, Dutch disease it's become a general term, but it originated with an oil boom in the 1960s in the Netherlands, and the oil boom had unintended consequences. In this case, specifically, it appreciated the Dutch guilder and made other exports uncompetitive. But it's since become a kind of catch-all term for the unintended and often negative consequences that occur when rapid sums of money pour in, often as the result of a natural resources boom, but not necessarily. So, in the case of sort of post-reconstruction, post-disaster reconstruction, you can have a situation where there's just too much money pouring and these societies aren't equipped to handle it, which, again, is not an argument against aid. It's just saying that aid needs to be channeled well. After the tsunami, you saw in many places in Banda Aceh in Indonesia, for example, and I think in parts of Thailand, you saw construction prices rise dramatically in large part as a result of tsunami reconstruction aid pouring in.
There are steps to greater stability that don't involve money. Talk about the impact of putting titles to newly rebuilt homes in the names of women survivors.
You know, that was one of the steps taken around here in particular at the tsunami, and it was a very sort of innovative policy decision, which, as you say, didn't involve money. It involved what you might call an intelligent channeling of money. The government and aid agencies realized that they were going to be rebuilding a lot of homes for people who actually had never even had proper sort of solid homes before. And one of the decisions they made is that they would put the titles to these homes not in the as traditionally would happen in the name of the men, but in the name of the women running the household, and sometimes in the joint name of the men and women. But that sort of radically, not only did it give a new home to survivors of the tsunami, but it also radically restructured social relations in the villages around here and gave a new level of sort of security and status to women in society.
Given forecasts of increasingly extreme weather worldwide in the foreseeable future, whether or not caused mainly by man, are there realistic prospects for more survivable reconstruction and relocation policies in vulnerable areas like the Philippines?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, some of the obvious things that probably will come out of this are sort of better building codes, perhaps hopefully better implementation of building codes, making sure that emergency services are sort of, you know, better located. I've been reading about hospitals flooded and things like that. And we have seen some of that post-tsunami. We also saw first responder and kind of emergency systems in place. I guess one of the things that I would really emphasize that should come out of disasters like this are better governance structures and better responsiveness of the administration. Because at the end of the day, all the warning systems in the world and all the money pouring in really depend on sort of local administration in particular being able to channel that money and being able to channel those warnings. We recently had an interesting thing in India where in the state of Orissa, a major cyclone hit the state of Orissa about a month or so ago. 1999, so a little over 10 years ago, a similar cyclone hit exactly the same area and 10,000 people died. This time, the government just seemed so much better equipped, evacuated almost a million people, and the deaths were in the 20s. And I think just most of the difference came down to better governance and better administration.
Thank you. Akash Kapoor is a frequent contributor to international magazines from Pondicherry in South India and author of India Becoming, A Portrait of Life in Modern India, published last year by Penguin.
Quote from the news, the courage and conviction to renew ourselves. That's what the leaders of China's Communist Party claimed they showed by easing its one-child policy, abolishing re-education labor camps, and encouraging more private competition in commerce and finance.
Next, about face on Obamacare and the political fallout for your ears only. With more For Your Ears Only, I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. With this quote from the news, the manipulation we've seen so far may just be the tip of the iceberg. That was Attorney General Eric Holder as the Justice Department investigates questionable practices by currency traders at nine of the world's largest banks, including Barclays, the Royal Bank of Scotland, and Citigroup. Also last week, Federal Reserve Chairman-designate Janet Yellen, in confirmation hearing testimony generally well-received by Wall Street, indicated no immediate tapering of economic stimulus and more oversight of the nation's giant banks. Now this.
I completely get how upsetting this can be for a lot of Americans, particularly after assurances they heard from me that if they had a plan that they liked, they could keep it. And to those Americans, I hear you loud and clear. I said that I would do everything we can to fix this problem, and today I'm offering an idea that will help do it.
The only way to fully protect the American people is to scrap this law once and for all. There is no way to fix this.
Facts on the ground last week finally forced Barack Obama to do what Republican threats and a government shutdown could not, at least in part. With millions of Americans angered by the cancellation of health insurance they liked and a growing chorus of congressional Democrats demanding action to help them, the president called for private insurers to restore those policies for a year while the problem-plagued federal exchange becomes a more operative path to better, perhaps cheaper, in many cases, subsidized plans.
House Speaker John Boehner continued his call to scrap the Affordable Care Act entirely. And his Republican majority, along with 39 Democrats, passed a bill that would go further than Obama did by permitting the sale of less comprehensive pre-ACA-type policies even to people who never had them before. If passed by the Democratic Senate, that could further undermine the actuarial basis of Obamacare, as well as the president's agenda and influence for the remainder of his second term. To consider all that and related issues for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Julian Zelizer, Princeton Professor of History and Public Affairs, author of Jimmy Carter and Governing America. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote last week that the underlying problem of Obamacare is not so much the inherent problems of big government bureaucracy as that it was not large enough and more governmental, and not dependent on coordination with the private insurance industry. You call it a failure of half-baked liberalism that we've seen before in recent, more conservative decades. Give us some examples.
Well, when Bill Clinton tried to expand health care, his program in 1993 was a similar version of this. Ultimately, that one failed. President Obama, many people think, went the wrong way with federal regulation, with Dodd-Frank, also creating a very weak and vague program that created plenty of room for loopholes. And I think liberals have started from a defensive position, and they've gone for these kinds of measures that have often created political problems and not delivered the kinds of benefits that are appealing.
By contrast, you cite the success of Social Security and Medicare, at least to date, and their continuing popular support. Make that case.
Well, the thing about those programs is less about regulation and more about benefits. Social Security is very clear. It taxes workers, but it then gives back benefits to the elderly. Medicare, similarly, is essentially national health insurance for the elderly. That's how it's worked since 1965. While both of those programs were hard to pass, they involved big fights against the status quo. When they ultimately went into effect, they were very hard to retrench. And they were very popular with conservatives and liberals all around the country because they provided a tangible benefit. That's not the kind of program we're talking about with ACA.
Doesn't the failure of the federal insurance exchange suggest that a bigger Obamacare might have encountered even more problems? Or would they be avoided by sidestepping private insurers?
I think by sidestepping private insurers and providing some public supplement, it would have been a hard fight, too, as this was. But the payoff would have been a lot bigger. You remember the public option was dropped in the middle of the debate, and now people are seeing why that might have been an important component. By relying on the private insurance system, ultimately the federal program was very fragile to start and was depending on a private industry that is broken to deliver better benefits. And I think that's part of the struggle the administration has faced.
Given increasing cries that government is the problem, didn't Obamacare need public endorsement and campaign support from those of the medical insurance pharmaceutical triad?
Not necessarily. I mean, when Medicare was passed in 1965, the AMA, the Doctors Association, called it socialized medicine. They handed out pamphlets to patients saying, don't let the government destroy your health care. But ultimately, the bill was pushed through. They gained gained other kinds of support. And doctors became very big fans of Medicare because it brought them patients, as did hospitals. So you don't always need the opponent to buy into the plan before it's passed. And sometimes building an alternative constituency can lead to a better program that then the opponents accept.
Some experts see more than a little theatrical spin in the current crisis, since insurance companies might well enjoy an advantage by continuing to sell more costly policies with fewer services they have to cover. They have a lot of private computer power for the recalculation involved, and all the insured are, to a significant degree, in the same national risk pool. What's your view?
Well, that's true. And, you know, there's two stages. The insurance industry stood to benefit from the program as it passed, because what it meant is the government was going to require more people to buy private insurance. And at some level, this weakened some of the controls that the government had put into place under this program to make sure bad insurance wasn't sold. So it could be true that in the end, they only stand to benefit even more, despite all the complaints from the changes that are now being made.
Well, to put the whole controversy in perspective, what portion of the nation's insured population are involved in the policy cancellations we've been hearing about?
You know, I believe it's about 7 to 10 million people out of about 263 to 64 million people who are insured. So it's still a small percentage of the overall insured, but it's a lot of people. So even if the percentage, if some could say, it's not a crisis and this can be alleviated, you're still talking about a sizable part of the population, and that's a political problem.
To what degree do you see Obama's larger agenda and political influence undermined by the health care disaster? Will we see more executive actions like the halt in deporting illegal immigrants with relatives in the armed forces that was announced last week to counter Boehner's refusal to permit a vote on immigration reform?
Well, it's certainly having negative effects. It's pushing all other issues off the agenda at this point, like immigration. It's not going to get through Congress. And it's causing him really huge political headaches with his own party, not just with the opposition, because this health care program was the measure of President Obama. And a lot of Democrats and Republicans don't have confidence in this president right now. So it hurts him with this program. It pushes other programs off the table. And it makes them harder to ask for more. So executive action might be the last path for him, but it's not a very satisfying way to enact changes, and it's something the next president can overturn easily.
And how do you see this all affecting next year's midterm elections, where GOP leaders were seeing such problems nationwide only weeks ago after taking so much blame for the shutdown?
Well, I'll tell you, if you'd asked me a couple weeks ago, I didn't think this was going to be a huge problem. But if this continues, this trajectory continues, I think this might be a huge boon to Republicans who could run on the campaign if we told you so. And President Obama is handing them an issue by having failed to set up the implementation effectively and efficiently.
Julian Zelizer, Princeton Professor of History and Public Affairs, author of Jimmy Carter and Governing America.
Quote from the news, they're closing it down in the morning and opening it up in the afternoon. That was an unnamed U.S. senator dismissing reports by inspectors of the International Atomic Energy Agency that Iran has slowed its nuclear expansion. But President Obama still had to argue against new sanctions to permit renewed diplomacy to block Tehran's production of nuclear weapons.
Next, the special problems of mental health care for your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. If he was scared, all he had to do was call 911. That was Gerald Thurswell, a lawyer for the family of Renisha McBride, a 19-year-old black Detroit woman who was shot and killed by Theodore Wafer, a 54-year-old white Michigan homeowner after a car accident and intoxicated as she sought help at a suburban doorstep. Wafer claimed fear of a break-in but was charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter. Now this.
Today, we've issued the final parity rule, which finally puts mental health services and substance abuse on equal footing with physical health services, and that's a huge step forward. Together with the Affordable Care Act, the rule allows us to expand and protect behavioral health benefits for 62 million Americans, some of whom have insurance without mental health coverage and others have no health insurance at all.
Mental health got a boost from the federal government earlier this month, with Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius finally announcing the rule to put treatment for mental illness on a par with treatment for physical illness. The law mandating parity between mental health care and physical health care was passed in 2008, but the final rule was required to specify just how parity gets implemented, including consumer protection, such as requiring insurers to charge similar copayments for mental health treatments and making clear deductibles and limits on visits are not more restrictive than for other ailments.
According to the National Institute of Mental Health, more than a quarter of Americans 18 and older are diagnosed with some type of mental disorder every year, and getting treatment for mental health has not always been easy. It's either not been covered under insurance plans or has been limited to a small number of visits and generally underfunded. Increased federal attention to parity and access in treatment may also improve what many see as inadequate and uncoordinated oversight and regulation of mental health facilities. Last week, for example, the Boston Globe reported on multiple staffing and treatment problems linked to the largest operator of freestanding psychiatric centers across the country, Universal Health Services. To talk more about that company and the health of mental health care generally, for your ears only, we have Globe Health and Science editor Gideon Gill. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
First, tell us about some of the problems that have cropped up in facilities owned by Universal Health Services in Massachusetts, the ones that first caught the Globe's attention.
Our reporter, Chelsea Conaboy, first reported earlier this year about problems with clinics owned by Arbor Health System, which is owned in turn owned by Universal. And she found that three of their clinics had repeatedly been cited for not having enough nurses and for allowing unlicensed or unsupervised workers to treat people. At one clinic, for example, there were all 23 of the therapists who worked there, state inspectors found, were not qualified to see patients on their own, yet were doing so.
North Carolina has had similar problems with that company.
Yes, and there was a hospital in North Carolina that regulators looked at last year and ended up taking steps to revoke a license actually right before it then got sold. But before that, they found that the hospital had lots of violence among patients there, and they blamed that on incompetent clinical staff.
And Illinois created a special investigation team to cope with the problems there.
Yes. So in Illinois, there was a hospital where the investigators, according to their state records, said that violence was, quote, an everyday occurrence. And they blamed that on understaffing. They found that problems actually at two other hospitals in Illinois as well.
What kind of response to all the charges did the Globe get from Universal Health Services?
Well, Universal did not allow us to interview company executives, but they did give us a statement where they said that their facilities regularly assess several key patient safety and quality metrics to ensure they're providing high-quality care.
But the problems exist, and one of the reasons, I gather, is that regulators in Massachusetts and many other states don't always look for patterns of bad behavior in different facilities with a common owner, and especially across state lines.
That's correct. So, as we learned when we began looking around the country, a lot of the same problems crop up at Universal facilities in many different states, but states, the way the regulatory system works, states regulate hospitals within their and facilities within their states. They don't tend to look outside. We talked to Ira Burnham, who's legal director of the Judge David Bazelon Center for Mental Health Law in Washington, and he said that the system is just it's handled to go incident by incident, review by review, and that this is ineffective when you're addressing systemic issues.
And Universal Health Services does some strategic charitable giving to polish its image in the industry, as one of your reporters discovered. One recipient was the National Alliance on Mental Illness, a patient advocacy group. What did they have to say about the problems connected with UHS after first denying they've ever heard of the company?
Yes, so UHS gave them $85,000 roughly earlier this year to support education programs and a fundraising event. And NAMI's legal director said to us that he said, I certainly think that we need to be aware and concerned that there are broad-based systemic allegations about a particular sponsor, but he cautioned that that what happens in one hospital is not necessarily reflective of systemic problems.
Do you expect more action on the federal level following announcement of the new parity guidelines equating mental and physical health care?
Well, states are chiefly responsible for regulating insurance plans, so monitoring whether plans actually do provide parity in coverage, I think, is going to be chiefly a state responsibility. The one thing the feds have done is that there is currently a federal investigation of a number of universal facilities. So the government, the Department of Health and Human Services Inspector General, in February issued subpoenas to 11 of Universal's psychiatric centers out of about almost 200 that they own nationwide, freestanding centers.
Gideon Gill is health and science editor of the Boston Globe.
Quote from the news, the scope, the callousness. That was Boston's federal district court judge Denise Casper on the bloody career of notorious gangster James Whitey Bulger in handing down two life sentences plus 5 years for 11 murders, 31 counts of racketeering, extortion, money laundering, drug trafficking, and weapons possession. Bulger, 84, who claimed that he had FBI immunity for his crimes, showed no emotion.
Next, why Camelot continues, 50 years since the JFK assassination, for your ears only.
Great. Quote from the news, the scope, the callousness. That was Boston's federal district court judge Denise Casper on the bloody career of notorious gangster James Whitey Bulger in handing down two life sentences plus 5 years for 11 murder charges, 31 counts of racketeering, extortion, money laundering, drug trafficking, and weapons possession. Bulger, 84, who claimed that he had FBI immunity for his crimes, showed no emotion.
Next, why Camelot continues, 50 years since the assassination, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. The terminology that keeps on coming to mind is leap of faith. That was NYU professor of medicine Baron Lerner on new guidelines released by the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association that recommend greater use of statin drugs and less concern about actual cholesterol levels. Now this.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
No words are strong enough to express our determination to continue the forward thrust of America that he began.
50 years since the day a shaken Walter Cronkite announced the assassination of America's 35th president, many of John Fitzgerald Kennedy's words still echo. And Lyndon Johnson, his vice president and successor, was just the first chief executive, Democrat and Republican, to link himself more or less accurately to Kennedy's memory. Ronald Reagan surprisingly may have made the closest match, according to a new book by Larry J. Sabato, founder and director of the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. It's The Kennedy Half Century, The Presidency, Assassination, and Lasting Legacy of John F. Kennedy from Bloomsbury Publishers. And to talk more about it, for your ears only, Professor Sabato joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Your reading on Reagan and Kennedy is less surprising if people remember how conservative Kennedy was in the early phases of his presidency. Remind us.
Well, he was indeed. It was a different era, of course, and both parties were anti-Soviet and used harsh Cold War rhetoric. I think also Democrats took a different stance on budget and debt issues. They may have been a bit more liberal than the Republicans, but at least up until the Kennedy administration, they certainly were not free spenders.
Most Americans fixed on other aspects of JFK when they ranked him highest among all U.S. presidents in a special poll done for your book. What is he best remembered for?
Well, sadly, he's best remembered for the assassination. We conducted the largest study ever done on a historical figure, a massive poll including all kinds of video segments and also focus groups around the country in major cities. And I was struck by the degree to which John Kennedy's image has been shaped by one day, his worst day, November 22nd. But let me supplement that by saying people do remember his call to land men on the moon, the beginnings of our active manned space program. They remember the Peace Corps. They remember the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And you've come up with new analysis of the famous police dictabelt, recording what some saw as indicating a second shooter along with Lee Harvey Oswald. Talk about what new technology tells us about that recording and what else you learned about it.
The second investigation of John Kennedy's assassination following the Warren Commission in the early 60s was, of course, the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the 1970s. They, after a three-year study, directly contradicted the Warren Commission, which had said that Oswald acted alone. Their evidence was a police recording made on a dictabelt at police headquarters at the time of the shooting, supposedly in Dealey Plaza, right where the shooting took place. We brought together the best audio experts available today using techniques that were not available in the 1970s. It turns out that we've exploded their report. They were completely wrong. The recording was made off of a stuck microphone 2.5 miles away from Dealey Plaza at the time of the assassination. There was zero chance that any gunshots of any sort could have been recorded on the dictabelt, and we also identified the source of the sounds. It turns out to have been the jiggling of the microphone on a running motorcycle.
Where do you stand on whether a larger conspiracy aided or inspired Oswald?
Here's where I stand. I was probably more conspiracy-minded when I went into this study 5 years ago, but I'm guided by the facts. I'm an academic. I now believe that Lee Harvey Oswald did fire those three shots from the sixth floor of the school book depository. He is the one who killed President Kennedy. He is the one who severely wounded Governor Connally. What I can't do is to rule out whether anyone encouraged him or provided assistance in any way. Why? Because there are too many unanswered questions, partly because of the failures of the Warren Commission, but I think even more so because Lee Harvey Oswald was killed 48 hours almost to the minute after he killed President Kennedy. We lost our source for the full story.
Let's look at how other presidents linked to Kennedy's memory and the myth of Camelot that Jackie Kennedy created. We heard Johnson talking about Kennedy's direction. We know he used that to help pass first the civil rights in JFK's honor and then his own great society. But as we said at the outset, you think Reagan came closest to the Kennedy mystique and underlying ideology. Give us some examples.
Well, he did. He quoted John F. Kennedy more than any Republican ever has. He found two ways to make common cause with the Kennedy legend. The first was, of course, Cold War rhetoric. He was still fighting the evil empire, the Soviet Union. All he had to do was quote John F. Kennedy to get Democratic support. Remember, he had a Democratic House of Representatives. He needed Reagan Democratic support. The second way he used Kennedy was to achieve his major domestic accomplishment early in his administration, the across-the-board tax cut. Because which president had had the first serious across-the-board tax cut? John F. Kennedy.
Your poll shows Kennedy most highly remembered by older Americans who actually lived through his presidency. Will his memory and legacy remain as potent for politicians and the public once those with personal memories have faded away?
The memory is bound to fade a little bit. But again, I look at the films and the videos of John F. Kennedy, not just delivering formal speeches, but at press conferences. He is the most able rhetorician, I think, of all the recent presidents, and his self-deprecating wit, his ability to inspire. These things translate well in the 21st century. Maybe they will always translate well.
Larry Sabato is founder and director of the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. His book is The Kennedy Half Century, The Presidency, Assassination, and Lasting Legacy of John F. Kennedy, from Bloomsbury with its own website, thekennedyhalfcentury.com.
Ask every person if he's heard the story, and tell it strong and clear if he has not. That once there was a fleeting wisp of glory called Camelot.
Richard Burton ends Camelot the musical. A quote from the news. If I would have had a mayor acting the way I've conducted myself, I would have done the same thing. That was Toronto's Mayor Rob Ford after the Toronto City Council overwhelmingly voted to strip him of some powers after he admitted to smoking crack, buying illegal drugs, and driving drunk, but still refused to resign.
Next, Andrea Markovici's birthday cabaret cocktail for Your Ears Only. A final chorus for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth. With a quote from the news, to make Alec Baldwin hers, whether he wanted to be or not. That was a New York prosecutor on the actions of Canadian publicist and sometime actress Genevieve Sabourin, sentenced to 7 months in jail for stalking and harassing the actor with 2 years of calls and emails after they dined in what she claimed was the start of a clandestine romance. Now this.
When I get older, losing my hair, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine. If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
If cabaret queen Andrea Markovici really felt the fear of that Beatles song she recorded back in 2000, it never showed. And now the threat is safely past. Crowds still hear her, fans still cheer her as she turns 65 and celebrates with a birthday tour show called Moonlight Cocktail that also celebrates the swank supper club society of a bygone era.
After appearances in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Chicago, Markovici marks her actual birthday this Monday, November 18th, at Joe's Pub in New York's Public Theater. Then it's on to suburban Westchester County and Long Island in New York and New Hope, Pennsylvania. But first, for Your Ears Only, she's on the line now with a preview. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you.
Some artists would consider 65th birthday tours a brave and foolish thing, to quote a song on another of your CDs. What made you see it as suitable for public celebration?
Well, I feel great. I'm strong. I'm happy. I'm enthusiastic still. And I guess I just wanted to share that exuberance with as many people as possible.
And how does the theme of your Moonlight Cocktail show, the supper club singers and songs of the 40s and 50s, connect with your birthday celebration?
Well, David, instead of celebrating myself, which I thought would be super egotistical, I decided to celebrate the people who have come before me, from Mabel Mercer to Bobby Short and from Portia Nelson to Billie Holiday, and to celebrate the nightclubs that I'm finding very inspiring, from the Bonsoir to the Blue Angel, the Maisonette, the Rubin Bleu, upstairs at the downstairs, and on and on.
You have a special connection with the venue in New York, Joe's Pub, at the late Joseph Papp's New York Public Theater. As an actress, talk about that.
Well, I actually started my entire career down there. I was in The Wedding of Iphigenia and Iphigenia in Concert, which was a really wiggy show. And later on, I was lucky enough to play opposite Sam Waterston as his Ophelia in Hamlet. So I started in the Village. I'm coming full circle to go down to the Village.
Well, you sold out Carnegie Hall, played Town Hall in Lincoln Center in New York. But talk about some of the more intimate venues you've played, like the late lamented Algonquin Hotel's Oak Room. What's their special charm, aside from clanking silverware and maybe a little too much drinking at some tables?
Well, I could do without the drinking, that's for sure. But the intimacy of the smaller rooms, and I will miss the Algonquin until the day I die. But close-up energy is what I love. It's electric. And the fact that you can see the effect of the songs you're singing on the eyes of the people that you're singing to, it changes the way you sing a song. So no matter what you've planned, it's never going to be the same way twice, because you can see what you're doing to the audience that has come to see you.
The song Moonlight Cocktail made its radio debut in 1942, the year I was born, but based on much earlier music. What can you tell us about it and why you chose it for your show?
Well, it was originally a rag way back in the teens, and then Glenn Miller turned it into this wonderful swing song, and then Kim Gannon made the lyric, which is so beautiful. It was recorded the day after Pearl Harbor. There's something in it that is so haunting and so yearning, but to me it seems like the beginning of a perfect evening. Therefore, I use it as the introduction to the entire night.
And the song All in Fun actually begins with the names of two famous supper clubs. Remind us, and was that its ticket of admission to your set list?
Absolutely. It starts with the Stork Club and the El Morocco. We are seen around New York, El Morocco and the Stork, and it allows me to start the opening monologue to the show.
Another of the songs is forever linked to the earlier cabaret queen Mabel Mercer. Isn't he adorable? You talked about it and her on our show several months ago before a big tribute to Mercer and Bobby Short. But for those who missed it, say more about what Mabel meant to you and the Great American Songbook.
Well, she's my complete inspiration. I have followed her music and her and everything about her. To me, she's almost a Shakespearean actress who acts in song. Her repertoire inspired me when I first started 28 years ago. I started doing midnight shows, and I called them Markovici at Midnight in honor of Midnight at Mabel's.
You've done shows and CDs focused on Cole Porter, on Irving Berlin, on Jerome Kern, among more than 30 you've created over the years. Also songs from the movies, from World War II, and from more contemporary sources, like those Beatles. Can you say which have been the most popular with audiences?
It's pretty easy, actually. I think the World War II music seems to strike a chord with people. And ever since I started doing it in 1991, it is still my most popular show. I'm actually doing a new version of it called A World War II Christmas, where I'm looking at the songs that were for Christmas that were written between 1939 and 1945.
Are there some you especially enjoyed performing? Maybe that night when Irving Berlin's daughter was at ringside?
Well, that's quite memorable. To be able to bring the music of Irving Berlin right into the hands of Irving Berlin's daughter. There was electricity in the room that night that was practically like a lightning bolt.
And she took my usual seat, I have to say.
Oh, the nerve of her.
Andrea Markovici.
You gave it up, David.
Andrea Markovici celebrates 65 and Supper Club Society in her show Midnight Cocktail at 7 and 9 p.m. on her actual birthday, Monday, November 18th, at Joe's Pub, 425 Lafayette Street in New York, including this.
For we are strictly good time Charlies who like to drink and dance around and maybe kick romance around, and that's the way it stands.
From All in Fun by Kern and Hammerstein, and this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on air is also online at iTunes, FeedBurner.com, and Stitcher.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions with intern Gene Moon. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts with support from the Gatewave.org Radio Reading Service for those with disabilities, the Jed Foundation, Fighting Campus Suicide, and award-winning ACAM Associates, exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. And please, pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. This week last year, we considered general confusion, including the extramarital affair that forced hero Army General David Petraeus out as head of the CIA and led a top Marine general to early retirement. From our November 18th, 2012 broadcast, hosted by Melissa and me.
I conducted over 700 interviews. You can appreciate how time-consuming that is, and then to transcribe them. And I was trying to do this really all on my own as a dissertation project. But when I realized the opportunity I had to tell this message, to present this portrait of strategic leadership, you know, it's not a hagiography. I'm not in love with David Petraeus, but I think he does present a terrific role model for young people, for executives, for men and women.
The president thinks very highly of General Allen and his service to his country, as well as the job he has done in Afghanistan. At the request of the Secretary of Defense, the President has put on hold General Allen's nomination as Supreme Allied Commander Europe, pending the investigation of General Allen's conduct by the Department of Defense IG.
It was Paula Broadwell herself who brought up being in love with David Petraeus, the legendary general and later CIA chief whose biography she was promoting earlier this year on the Arthur Cade YouTube channel. But as anonymous emails she sent to a female friend of Petraeus in Tampa suggested, and as a subsequent FBI probe of all of her emails proved, Broadwell and Petraeus did have an adulterous affair. The email trail led by last week to Petraeus' resignation from the agency and to questions about another four-star general, current Afghanistan commander John Allen, who had massive internet exchanges with the same lady in Tampa, as acknowledged by White House Press Secretary Jay Carney.
The Petraeus affair, though it apparently occurred after his uniformed service, was just the latest in an unusually high number of ethical scandals involving U.S. generals and admirals this last year. And it could hardly have been worse for the CIA. Petraeus still had to appear at closed-door congressional hearings about intelligence and communications failures surrounding a 9/11 attack that killed the U.S. ambassador to Libya and three other Americans at the consulate in Benghazi.
Also last week, Iran took another step closer to nuclear weapons capability, and Israel moved closer to a new ground war in Gaza after a series of rocket and airstrike exchanges with Hamas militants, which raised questions about how the region's major player, Egypt, would respond given its new, more Islamic government. To consider the general confusion, we're joined again by former Assistant Secretary of Defense Lawrence Korb, now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Welcome back to the program.
It's nice to be with you again.
Once Petraeus admitted his affair to the FBI, even though there was apparently no security breach, could he have resisted resignation, knowing the information was likely to get out?
No, I don't think so, because his credibility with other folks in the agency, his reputation in the military, and even he's going to need time to heal things with his family. So, no, I think he did the right thing, by stepping down, because we need to focus on all of the other issues that you've been talking about, from Benghazi to the situation in Gaza.
There are reports of a special Pentagon effort to raise ethical standards at the highest levels of the military. Do you think that's necessary on the basis of recent evidence? Is it likely to be effective?
Well, I think it's good for them to, kind of reemphasize the stuff that they should. But see, here's what's happened. I mean, the military is like other institutions, and it has its strengths and weaknesses. But because of these wars that have gone on now for a decade, because we have such a small percentage of the population fighting it, we've elevated the military to a pedestal that they really don't deserve. And so I think this is just a lot of these things coming to light. Shows that this has been a lot of these things have been going on for a while. For example, last year in the military, they had 20,000 cases of sexual violence. We didn't pay attention to it. Now, with these other things, I think people are going to focus on that issue.
On the Benghazi issue, Petraeus last week said he knew from the start it was terrorism, not an out-of-control protest against that American-made anti-Islam film. He says that view was reflected in the CIA analysis but removed from the talking points made by U.N. Ambassador Susan Rice. Now, critics say it was a political decision to keep Libya from looking like an Obama policy failure as the election approached. Others say there was conflicting evidence that the film was at least a factor and a security decision to hide our intelligence about al-Qaeda connections to the consulate attackers. What's your best understanding on all that?
Well, I think what happened is that they wanted to put Susan Rice out there because she's very, very, articulate person. And I think they were probably showcasing her to be Secretary of State. But she was the wrong person, I think, to put there. As the president said in this press conference, she, had nothing to do with it. There's no doubt about the fact that the unclassified talking points that she has, I mean, she was following those. The real issue is, if you were uncertain about it, why did you even let her, go on there? And basically, even if, in fact, as it turned out, it was a terrorist attack, this was not, another 9/11, the attack that happened on 2001. And I think the White House, to the extent that they were involved, sort of overreacted to it. Yes, this group had some ties to al-Qaeda, but they have as much connection to al-Qaeda Central as your local BP gas station does to BP headquarters. So I think it was a lot of overreaction on the part of a lot of people involved in this.
Well, that's overreaction. What about underreaction? And your reaction to all the evidence that the late ambassador and many other U.S. representatives in Libya previously asked for more security but were turned down?
Well, I think, again, we have to find out why they were turned down, who turned them down, what was the reason. But, again, you know, it's very interesting. This week I was at a program at the Middle East Institute, and Ambassador Crocker spoke. You know, he was our ambassador both to Afghanistan and Iraq. And he said one of the things that's important to keep in mind, you can't provide perfect security. Ambassadors need to get out, and they know that they're risking things. He did have some security with him. But a lot of misunderstanding, people say, well, we should have sent the Marines. No, the Marines don't guard ambassadors. They basically control classified information in the assembly, so in the embassy. So the real question is exactly what would have been involved in terms of more security in Benghazi or more security for the ambassador, because the ambassador is mainly up in Tripoli.
Especially as the still quite weak government in Libya was really fearful or not happy at the thought of looking like there was yet another American occupation.
Well, and again, I think that's the real issue. You know, from what we know now, the Benghazi really wasn't a consulate. It was kind of a CIA outpost, which again raises all kinds of other questions. What was the CIA doing there? What was their role? As what I understand, I think what they were trying to do is, make sure that some of these weapons didn't fall into the wrong hands, weapons that, existed during the overthrow of Gaddafi.
Let's turn to the Gaza situation. An earlier Israeli ground action did not make for long-term security, and experts say Hamas has even more and better weapons to fight back. What would you expect?
Well, I don't think there'll be a ground invasion. I think they're trying to show that they could have the ground invasion. But I think the Israelis have made their point that you can't just continue with these rocket attacks without paying some price. The real issue, as you said in your run-up, is what role will Egypt play? Because previous in the past, Egypt would get Hamas to back off. Now, the question is, what will the new government under President Morsi do? Will they lean on Hamas because they're trying to balance their, their tendency toward the Muslim Brotherhood, which supports it, plus trying to get aid from the United States? Because, again, if they don't play a constructive role, they got a couple of $1 billion in aid that they probably won't get.
Thank you. Former Assistant Secretary of Defense Lawrence Korb is now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress.
General confusion from our November 18th, 2012 broadcast. General Petraeus left the CIA for teaching positions at USC, the City University of New York, and the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. He also became chairman of the KKR investment firm's Global Institute, but still figured in lingering questions about the U.S. diplomatic post in Benghazi before and after an extremist attack that killed the ambassador and three other Americans. General Allen, though cleared of improprieties, retired to become a distinguished fellow at the Brookings Institution and a senior advisor to the Secretary of Defense.
Questions about Benghazi also prompted a threatened Republican hold on several top Obama nominations, and it led the CBS News show 60 Minutes to air an expose charging a cover-up of al-Qaeda responsibility for the attack that included no solid substantiation or sourcing. Indeed, the show had to apologize for depending heavily on a private security operative who apparently had not visited the outpost as he claimed in the broadcast, and in a new book published by a CBS subsidiary, which connection was not initially acknowledged. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, with the JFK assassination 50 years ago still in mind, all of actor Richard Burton's finale to Camelot the musical.
Each evening, from December to December, before you drift to sleep upon your cot, think back on all the tales that you remember of Camelot. Ask every person if he's heard the story, and tell it strong and clear if he has not, that once there was a fleeting wisp of glory called Camelot. Camelot, Camelot, once it never rained till after sundown. By 8 a.m. the morning fog had flown. Don't let it be forgot that once there was a spot for one brief shining moment.